Thank you, Jorge. Thank you, Bai. So welcome, everybody. I was going to say I'm glad to be here. I mean, here in Marseille or here at the telephone. What I'm going to talk about is a series of calculation and a general idea for calculating low energy quantities from loop quantum gravity. And this is an idea that has been developing for a few years, but there is a very small number of papers. So you can put the second transparency, please. I've made the entire list of papers in this direction, which is completed so far. There are four papers that regard the calculations in four dimensions. The first one is just the general idea, the strategy of how to do. The second one is the first actual calculation of the propagator. But if you want to some of you are interested in more, what you want to look at is the third paper. The third paper is much longer than and all the others, and there are all the details. There is the same content as the second plus, the first and the second plus more. The paper number four is a recent thing done by Terai and Simonin, which they have a better boundary state. And the next two papers are in three dimensions, where, of course, things can be done much better and much more. The last paper, which in my version of transparency is at the 6th instead of the 7th, is a earlier paper which is not very much connected to this, but it discusses the general relation between the graviton states, the gravitons, if you want, and so their endpoint functions, and the geometry-to-geometry transition amplitude, which is the object one naturally thinks about in quantum gravity. And it discusses it not in loop quantum gravity, but certainly in the context of a general perturbative theory. So I put it there because it was an inspiration, was a source of various of ideas here. So let's go to next transparency. I have just I just want to just start from a one transparency on how I see where we are in general in loop quantum gravity, just to put all this in context and to tell how I think of the various pieces that are needed to do this kind of calculation. So roughly the theory can be thought in two parts. There's a kinematical part, which is pretty well defined. There is a separable kinematical Hilbert space, which is solidly defined, also even if there are at least a couple of different ways of defining it. Of course, everybody has its own preferred ways, but that's good, that's fine. These states have a geometrical interpretation, which is given by the operators that are related to geometrical quantities. And the aspects that are less clear regard the multi-parameter and exactly what Hilbert space to use in the Lorentzian case. So this I will not be bothered here by this because I'm doing everything in the Euclidean case. And of course, we can say something about Lorentzian at the end if there is a question. But here what I'm doing, what I want to do is compute endpoint function in Euclidean quantum gravity. So that's the kinematics of background independent quantum gravity. And then the dynamics there are two main avenues for defining it. Either writing a Hamiltonian operator, and of course this also exists in more than one formulation, including recent Thomas Master constraint direction, or by sort of more covariantly using a spin foam techniques. And there are a number of models. In any case, one has to define a triangulation independent spin foam formalism. And the way I will refer to here is group field theory, because it has, at least in some versions, good finiteness properties, and because it has an expansion parameter where that allow me to do perturbative calculations, which are not perturbative around flat space, but nevertheless, there is an expansion. expansion parameter. We'll go back to this. One of the sort of weakest aspects of this is that it is not entirely clear, at least to me, how to interpret exactly this expansion parameter. I mean, it's completely clear internally in the theory, but it's not clear how what is one expanding in. I mean, ultimately, it should be an expansion in the Planck length. But the connection between the expansion of the Planck length and the vertex number of vertices expansion in lambda it's not completely clear. But nevertheless, the theory is pretty well defined in the sense that we know how to compute certain amplitudes. And this will be one of the starting points. The philosophy here is not that the particular version of group field theory and spin form that I use is not that which is interesting to me. It's the problem is how to compute low energy physics. And the idea was just to choose a model in which the computation can be done to find a way for doing these computations. And then, of course, this computation can be repeated in different models, in different contexts. But what is more interesting to me is find a general way for computing low-energy physics and endpoint particle scattering, if you want, from the background independent theory. Now, in most of the spin form models, the vertex that defines the theory is the Baryt-Crane vertex, or the 10J symbol, which has been shown by a combination of these people written in green to be related to general relativity explicitly in the large length, the limit, in the low energy limit, so to say, or large scale limit. As in that equation there, namely the vertex, which is a function of the spin. For large spins, approximate the exponential of the Einstein-Hilbert action, or more precisely the Regge action, which in turn approximates the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is very good, because somehow this knows about the Einstein equations, of course. So the vertex knows somehow about the Einstein equations. So that's the good news. But the bad news is that it's not just e to the Regge action is also sum of three terms, and the second one is e to the minus Regge action, and the third one is some other term which is related to degenerate simplices. And this is the presence of these other two terms was sort of a cloud that disturbed and shed some doubts on the entire approach for a while. And one of the side results of all this calculation that I'm going to show you is that it gives a way to cure this this problem. This was not expected; was not one of the motivation of doing that. It somehow came out as a bonus. So this is the overall picture. Now the next transparency, I've just written the issue I want to address. With all that basic theory in the previous transparency in various versions and many things one can do. One can do cosmology, one can do black holes, one can do matter, etc., etc., etc. But there are open issues, and to my way of viewing the key open issue is to compute particle scattering amplitude for a number of reasons. One is that we don't have a good control of low energy limit of the theory. We don't even know for sure that this is general relativity in the sense that we started from general relativity and we wrote the theory that it's quantum theory. So naively, the naive classical limit is obviously GR, but this is different from taking the quantum theory and computing quantities explicitly and showing that in an appropriate limit, which here is a large distance limit, this goes to GR. And in particular, we don't even know explicitly how to compute the Newton law. So we don't know in this theory how to say that apples fall. In addition, if we want to talk with a particle physicist, we have to translate to their languages, and the scattering amplitude is sort of the better handle on a quantum field theory. the most knowledge that one has, and we have to be able to compute scattering amplitude. Some limits. General relativity is supposed to describe the sort of small excitations of small gravitational waves, so gravitons, that in some limit they're going to interact, and we have to be able to compute the interaction. Finally, as was mentioned by Abai last week, if one takes general relativity and does a standard perturbative expansion, a quantum field theoretical perturbative expansion, the theory is non-normalizable, which means that one can define everything, but one has an infinite number of constant, free constant, the normalization constant that one has to fix. So the dream here is to compute the endpoint functions in such a way that all these constants are fixed. And this would breach entirely with the quantum field theory formalism if one gets there, and show in which sense that this non-perturbative formulation addresses the non-normalizability. So, okay, so this is a problem, and next transparency is the why there is a problem. And the why, there's a traditional way of saying why there is a problem, which is the following. It's well known from all introduction to quantum gravity, which is the following. Suppose you have a two-point function in a quantum field theory. That's expression for a two-point function. And suppose this quantity is well-defined, and the action, S of phi, is the general covariant, and the measure is general covariant. Okay, suppose you have been able to define that. Then it's just a change of variables in the integral. If you do a diffeomorphism on the field, you transform phi of x into the diffeomorphic transformed one, change coordinates, so you get phi of f of x. And nothing else changes, so the quantity doesn't change because if measure and action are invariant under diffeomorphism. So the two-point function is equal to the two-point function calculated in two other points. So whatever is f in the second equation, this equation holds, which means that as long as x and y are not on top of each other, the two-point function is a constant, which is dramatic because we don't know how to go ahead. I mean, somehow it's a completely different ground than standard quantum field theory. Now, this argument, it's not totally clean. For instance, as recently Eugenio Bianchi was pointing out, well, the first equation to really define it, you have to fix a gauge, and then if you fix a gauge, you are not really working a gauge invariant, etc. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, in a generally covariant formalism, you want to compute things which are physical, which are independent of the coordinates, and a two-point function that depends on the coordinates cannot have any physical meaning. So even if you can define a functional W of x and y, then whatever quantity you want to compute cannot be something that depends on the coordinates. So the very notion of endpoint functions is very confused here. X and Y on Minkowski space are characterized by a given distance. X and Y on a diffeomorphism on a differential manifold are characterized by nothing, just by not being on top of each other. So this is a difficulty, and this is a well-known difficulty, and people have gone around for years, I would say decades around this difficulty, and all this work comes from an idea of how to address this difficulty, and this is the next part.
Carlo, towards the ends of sentences, your voice trails off.
Okay. So should I talk more loudly? Loudly?
Little bit.
Okay. So this is transparency number six, and we are getting to the core of the matter, and we begin to look at what is the idea of how to define an endpoint function, or in particular a two-point function, that makes sense in a general covariant context. So, first of all, a first step is to define a quantity, which is well-known in quantum field theory. It's actually used a lot, for instance, by people on the lattice, which is a functional integral in a finite space-time region. So this blue region is a space-time region, so four-dimensional. At given fixed value of the boundary field. The boundary field, I write it with this script phi, And so I define a W, a quantity W, which is a function of the surface. Sigma is the boundary surface of the region, and phi is the boundary value of the field on the region, by doing the functional integral inside. So just definition. If I now start from the definition of the two-point function, in which the functional integral is inside and outside, and of course on the boundary surface itself, and I break the integral, in the integral inside, the integral outside, and the integral on sigma, on the boundary surface, and I perform explicitly the integral inside and the integral outside, I end up with the second equation here. And the second equation is still the two-point function. So it's just a formal manipulation in which I have explicitly performed the integration inside, getting this W defined upstairs. And I've explicitly performed the integration outside, basically the same thing, getting something which I call psi, just for because I will be a little bit like a state later on, so we'll come back to that. And what remains is just the integration on the boundary itself of the boundary field with insertions of the two fields. So here the 2 points x and y are taking on the boundary on sigma, and this is just a simple rewriting of the definition of a two-point function. And this formula has been explored in the context of standard field theories on Minkowski by Florian, by Luisa, by Federico Mattei, by other people, and it sort of works in various ways. One can work with this formula. One can compute explicitly the free theory W psi and do this integral explicitly, even if it becomes more and more complicated. Of course, if the shape of the function of the sigma and or the blue region becomes complicated. So this is just definitions. Now let's go to next transparency, number 7, and see what happens if I do this in a diffeomorphic invariant theory. So now let me assume that everything is well defined, that these functional integrals are well defined, and that the action and measure, everything is diffeomorphic invariant as it should. Then exactly for the same reason as before, that the result of the integration doesn't depend on x and y, here the result of the integration doesn't depend on x and y, it doesn't depend on sigma, and in particular this boundary functional doesn't depend on sigma. It just depends on the boundary field. This is general covariance. If I fix the boundary value of, say, the gravitational field, and integrate inside, the result should not depend on the coordinates I've used for defining the boundary surface, sigma. In other words, I can draw my sigma small or large or square or round. It shouldn't matter because everything is related by coordinate transformation. Therefore, the two-point function, I have just copied the last equation of the previous page. In a general covariant context, the dependence on sigma drops, just taking away the dependence of sigma. However, there is something else that changes, which is that on a Minkowski space-time, when I do the functional integral, I demand the fields to go to zero at infinity. In a general covariant context, this is far from clear how to implement anything like that. There isn't a preferred boundary condition at infinity that I can impose to the functional integral, unless, of course, I'm doing asymptotic flux, which is not what I'm doing here. So, therefore, psi isn't really well defined. I don't know what is psi in this context, because I don't know how to put the boundary condition at infinity, or said in a different language. In general relativity, there isn't a preferred vacuum state. There's no notion of a vacuum state. There's no energy, so there's no notion of minimal energy. There is a preferred solution of Einstein equations, which is better than the other ones, unless I add some extra constraint to the series. So there is a freedom in choosing. I can look at this formula without knowing what is the state, the boundary state psi. But here comes the point, and this is a sort of the central argument from which all the rest derives. In a theory on a fixed background, if I have a surface, then what I measure depends on where the surface is, of course, and depends in particular geometry of the surface, because I can make Poincaré transformation, displace it, so it's not where it is, but it's what shapes it has. Here, nothing seems to depend on the geometry of sigma. But of course, we know why, because in general relativity, there are two geometries. There is the geometry, the coordinate geometry, and there is the physical geometry. The coordinate geometry is not physical, doesn't mean anything. What matters is the physical geometry, which is determined by the gravitational field. So in other words, the geometry of sigma that matters in a general relativistic context is not how sigma is written in coordinate space, but is what is the value of the gravitational field on it. And in a quantum field theory, the geometry, or the quantum geometry, is determined by the value of the quantum state of the gravitational field over it. So on psi. In other words, in that equation, the different psi that I can have, I can interpret them simply as different quantum geometries on the boundary surface. That's a key point. And I'll just repeat it in a few different ways, come back from various perspectives. But therefore, if this is true, let me choose a state, psi, and I'm now talking about the last equation of this transparency, which is a state picked on a given geometry, three geometry here, on this surface sigma, and call this state psi q. Then what I can compute depends explicitly on q, and I can define a quantity w, and this is the last, the third equation of this transparency, that depend on x, y, and q, so depend on this boundary geometry, defined in that way. So it's this functional integral where the state is not an abstract vacuum state obtained and integrating outside with the fixed boundary condition infinity, but is a state that I choose that describes a given boundary geometry. Now, this quantity, this is a definition, depends on a given geometry on two points, and now the advantage that I have is that I can interpret these two points as points on the metric space determined by this geometry here. So I can take, for instance, and that's what I will do, the Q to be the geometry of, a three-sphere, and put the two points at the antipodes of this three-sphere or at a certain angle separation, one between the others. So W depends on a given geometry, three geometry, and on two points on it, and is defined by this expression here. And now, this quantity is well-defined in a general covariant quantum field theory. In a sense, it doesn't live on a coordinate space. It lives on the state itself. It lives on psi q itself. Right? So I'm just living on quantum states of geometry. But if this has a decent classical, if the theory has a decent classical limit, then this should be connected to the two-point functions computed in the background-dependent theory whenever x and y are points on a surface with a geometry q embedded in background space-time. Let's go to the next transparency to see what all this means physically.
Okay, let's just one clarification, Carlo.
Yes.
On the transparency 7 that you were just talking about.
Yes.
The time and distance really depend on the volume, the metric in the bulk in the interior as well, right? Does not just depend on the geometry of the surface.
Ah, okay. So, you mean the time distance between x and y in the linearized theory with which I'm comparing it? Is that the question, right? So they depend on just on the metric on the geometry of the boundary surface in the following sense: that if I have that boundary geometry, there will be generically, one solution of Einstein equations inside that has that boundary. And then I can compute the distance between the point x and y in the bulk geometry determined by this boundary value Q. That's
right.
Clear?
So yeah. You are implicitly assuming that this Q, which is supposed to be both the metric and the extrinsic curvature of
yes.
the boundary,
yes.
satisfies some kind of constraint equations.
Oh, yes. That's correct. That's correct, yes.
I have a question also.
Yes.
Maybe it's related. The two-point function you...
Laurent?
You, yes, it's Laurent.
Hi, Laurent.
Hi. So you wrote it as a function of the metric Q, but the problem is that it depends also not only on the metric Q, but on this representative state that you're choosing, psi of Q. So there is an extra layer of ambiguity in this choice.
So yes, absolutely.
What is the information or the physical information that is encoded into two different psi that represent the same Q?
The answer to the first question is yes, definitely. And the answer to the second question is that I expect in the large distance limit to what I would like is the large distance limit of the propagator to be independent of that, and getting close to the Planck length, if I'm testing the state psi of Q for the same Q, that's what you're saying, right? There may be different state psi which are picked on the same geometry. I may get different results. So, in other words, I don't know. This is all to explore. Psi of Q, that's what Abai was implicitly hinted before, is far from being very free. It there's a lot of constraints over it, and how much the Planck, the quantum correction depend on its form is something I don't know.
Okay.
So far, what I really have tried to do is to look at the low energy limit.
So
yeah,
ideally there should be an equation constraining further psi of Q. That's what you expect.
Because I think he says that the Q is supposed to be not just a geometry, but the not only the metric, but the metric and the extrinsic curvature.
Yes.
About which psi is sharply peaked. And Laura is completely right that there may be many states which are sharply peaked.
Yes.
But I guess Carlo's point is that if, in fact, you are allowing fluctuations around a mean value Q, which are a Planck size, then if the distance between X and Y with respect to the four metric which
yep.
is compatible with the boundary data is very large compared to the Planck length, then the leading term would be something that would be pretty universal, and that's the idea. And there will be subleading terms, which will be corrections of the order of Planck length, which is the fluctuation in the state, divided by the distance between the two points. So I think, I imagine that one is not saying that there are not going to be subleading terms. But the question is really whether the leading term goes at the correct power of the distance. Is this correct, Carlo?
Yeah, it's completely correct, yes.
Yeah.
Laurent, you want to add something?
No, so I agree. Yeah, the leading term will be okay, but suppose we're interested into the subleading term, like
yeah, exactly.
the graviton propagator. So then this subleading term will contain two parts, one part which is truly dynamical, which is the quantum gravity part, and one part which is coming from the choice of these states. And then there should be a way to disentangle these two contributions.
Yes. Yes. Nothing of this is clear to me. So I'm just telling you what I see, what I know. I don't know to which extent this state psi it can be fixed with all the constraints we have. So far, my interest was finding whether there is a psi that does the job to the first order.
This is Simone. If I can add a comment to this. However, we do have an example of this discussion, because In the papers you were mentioning at the beginning, we have already examples of two different states which have exactly this property, that in the large they will produce the same results, but they will give different subleading corrections, in fact.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes, I mean, all this is the physics that is opened up if this formula works. I agree. I don't have answers to this. I just see a lot of things to explore and to try to understand. But I mean, I agree with Laurent's point, namely that in principle there is a relation between the state psi, what we know, what we don't know about the state psi, and the physics that we extract from it. So I just my aim is to connect this with to find a way to read out this physics in terms of endpoint functions. Can I go ahead?
Yes, do.
Okay. So let's go to the next transparency 8 and give a physical picture of what's going on. So I'm making a step back with respect to this discussion, just to justify this what is going on here. The point is that in general relativity, what happens is that the geometry becomes a gravitational field, right? So a measurement of geometry is a measurement of the gravitational field. So there isn't any more a clear distinction. Actually, there isn't any more a distinction between measurements of distance and time lapses and measurement of fields, or quantum fields, namely particles. So suppose we are at CERN and we make a scattering experiment. We have some particle detectors. We have an interaction region, which is this gray region here, space-time region. But the apparatus we are using for this measurement is not just the particle detector. It's the particle detector and the whatever we use to measure distances and time, and in particular to measure frequencies and to measure wavelengths. So momenta and energies are implicitly we have clocks and meters. Now, clocks and meters are, from the point of view of general relativity, measurements of the gravitational field. So from the point of view of general relativity, the objects that measure the gravitational field, the clocks and the rods, are on the same conceptual plane as the particle detector themselves. Therefore, we don't expect an endpoint function, a quantity W that captures the physics here, just depend on the number of particles, which is what the particle detector and their position X and Y with respect to some predetermined geometry, but they should depend on the number of particles and some measurements of the gravitational field, and therefore some state of the gravitational field that somehow captures these measurements. So this is what we have been trying to define here, a quantity W that just depends on the state of the gravitational field and the number of particles, and that in some appropriate limit should become, when we look at the background dependence theory, the usual conventional endpoint function. So this is a philosophy, so to say. Now let's see how to do this and go to the next transparency number 9. So here is the plan of what to do. The first equation, I've just copied the previous equation. This, so far, I was working with just formal manipulation of functional integrals. Now we want to make this for real in mathematical sense. So all these quantities should become well-defined quantities, and so far I've never mentioned Loop quantum gravity. Here is the moment in which we just resort to Loop quantum gravity, to the theories we have, in all possible versions and form, and the spirit here is just like let's took the chapters that work better and the versions that work better for doing this calculation. So first of all, we have the integral over dc. So this is the integral of the boundary value of the field. So the field here is the gravitational field. So this is the integral of the boundary value of the gravitational field. Now you can view the first equation as you can interpret it formally as that expectation value of the two operate, sorry, of the scalar product between W state and the phi state sandwiching the two operators phi of x, phi of y, right? So what is really going on here mathematically is that we can define a Hilbert space of gravitational state on the boundary, and we really compute a scalar product in this state space here. So the idea is to identify this boundary state with the Hilbert, with this state space, with the state, namely roughly the gravitational state, quantum gravitational state on the boundary, with a Hilbert space of two quantum gravity, and there we have a basis, so we know how to take scalar product, we have a discrete basis, so this integral becomes a sum over the basis states, which are the S-naughts, namely the most invariant classes of spin networks. So that's what dφ becomes, and accordingly, W of P becomes a W of S of the S naught, and the psi of Q is going to be psi Q of S of the S naught, so I have to write the states in this basis.
Hey, Paolo.
And, yes.
Paolo, can I ask you a question for clarification?
Yes.
In this first item of the list, on the left side, you have an integral over concrete fields in this surface sigma, right?
Yes.
And then you go over to a sum over S naught. Isn't there something non-trivial happening here? At first, you have something concrete embedded, and then you're going to a kind of diff-invariant abstract spin network. How do you do that? Do you choose some embedding for the S naught into sigma, or what do you think here?
No. The idea was that before I was working in an abstract way, assuming that phi is whatever field I have, and here I'm saying gravitational field, that dφ is some diffeomorphic invariant measure, and that W psi are obtained by taking the diffeomorphic invariant generativity action. So now there was nothing concrete at that point. So in other words, before dφ was sort of the, if you want to view it concrete, was the integral on the equivalence classes of gravitational fields up to diffeomorphism, something that nobody knows what to do about, right? So it was not concrete before, that's with respect to your question, and it's becoming concrete only now. So before was formal manipulation, functional integral, right? Believing we know what the theory is.
And what was the meaning of x and y then?
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah, very good. Sorry. This is what your question. So your question was much more subtle than what I thought. Yes. The X and Y is, this as I've been told more than once, is probably a bad notation here. What I mean here is that in this formula there is a Q, which is a two geometry of a given surface sigma. So what is given here is a two geometry, in particular a three metric, so a three-dimensional manifold with a metric, and X and Y are points on these three metrics, okay? So when I write the operator phi of x and phi of y, when this becomes concrete, I will have to define it in remembering that. This will happen in the fourth line when I define this operator concretely. So the next transparency is I will define w psi and phi one by one, and you will see exactly what I mean by x and y. X and y are defined with respect to Q. So they are not, nothing depend on coordinates here in this definition. Is that an answer, Florian?
Yeah, we can go on.
Okay. So the first thing to make concrete is this functional integral, and that's, in a sense, the easiest from our point of view, because this becomes just like taking scalar products in loop quantum gravity, and we know how to do it. It's just sum over the S naught, in a sense. We have a basis, and we know the this is an orthonormal basis, so we know how to take this product. Now, the second line I was saying, we have to define the W, and the W has to be written on this basis, so it's a function of the S naught. intuitively, each one of these S is an S not is is an abstract geometry, right? It's a three-dimensional abstract geometry, three-dimensional quantum matrix, so to say. And this will be defined by using the spin form formalism, and in particular the group field theory. It will happen in the next transparency. Then we have to define the quantum state. We have to write explicitly a quantum state that is in some sense a coherent state. This coherent here is in a very loose sense, a state peaked on this on a given geometry. And then I have to write the operators, and these operators act on the state and create an excitation, and they will, the problem here will be exactly what Florian was saying, understanding what is X refers to Q. So if I am able to write explicitly what I mean by W, what I mean by Q, by Psi, what I mean by C, I can write the second equation there, and this becomes a well-defined expression. So let's take this three ingredients, W, Psi, and Phi, one by one, and say exactly what they mean. So let's go to the next transparency, number 10, and start with W. So this is the point is that group field theory gives you exactly a W. That's what it's, what's good about field theory. The group field theory directly, and it's in the spin form force. So in just the one transparency, I'm summarizing this. If you don't know group field theory, you're not going to understand anything. You'll just believe it that this is what comes out. If you know field theory, the first equation is a sort of a summary of the idea of the group field theory. You have an auxiliary field theory, which I have had the very, very bad idea of calling the field with the same notation as the original field in my transparency. It has, of course, nothing to do with it. So there is an auxiliary field P on the group manifold with a very simple action, which is a kinetic term and a potential phi to the fifth. And the point is that the observables of this theory can be interpreted as the defined directly amplitude for spin networks. The way it works is if I just take this theory blindly and I do a Feynman expansion in the coupling constant lambda, this exponential value becomes a sum over spin forms, and the vertex here is exactly the vertex that was in the original transparency, so the thing which is has to do with Einstein gravity, and the things I'm summing over the sigma, namely the spin form, can be interpreted as geometry, so this expression can be interpreted as a discretized version of the Hawking sum over geometries, which is the last transparency here. Yeah. In other words, this spin form formalism group theory is just a way to give meaning to the functional integral inside, which is what I wanted to do, and what it does is just define something which hopefully, that's what we hope, is an approximation to the functional integral inside. And what's specific is that on the boundary, I don't have just a continuous geometry, but I have a spin network, which is a discrete quantum geometry. Now, the advantage of doing it in the group field theory is that, first of all, I don't have to choose any background triangulation, anything like that. I'm summing over all the spin forms inside. If you want, I'm summing over all triangulation inside, and in my basic formula, I'm summing over the spin network on the boundary, but there is an expansion parameter, lambda, and what I want to do is just look at first order in lambda. And at first order in lambda, if we go to the next transparency 11, just think about QED. If you look a three-point function to first order in QED, you just have the vertex. And here, to first order, basically you just have the vertex. The only thing that exists to first order is the vertex. And the vertex here, remember that the interaction terms was phi to the fifth, the vertex is a five-valent thing, so it's five legs, and it corresponds to a spin form inside, which is just five nodes, And it has this shape here. So more precisely, to first order, the only non-vanishing term in W of S is when S is a spin network that has that pentagonal graph. All the rest, all the other W of S is zero for all the other S except this one. So the only remaining variables on which that characterize it, on which to sum, are the spins, the J, the 10 spins here, and the five intertwiners. So we have explicitly W of S, in other words, which is given there. It's just the vertex times the measure factor that comes from the theory. And this is what it is to first order in lambda. So let's go to the next transparency. And, of course, this simplifies enormously the problem also as far as the boundary state is concerned. Because the boundary state, in principle, we want it for any possible network on the boundary. But we have seen that we're summing of all spin networks, that W is zero unless, except for the spin networks that have that pentagonal graph. So we're only interested in the psi, the value of psi on this pentagonal graph. The rest doesn't contribute to first order. So we have to build it. And let me say up front that Simone and Etera have a better definition of the state, and in the big paper already, there is a better definition of space. I'm giving here the simplest construction of the state, the first we have used, knowing that one can do better. So the idea is that we have a geometry. So let's choose a geometry, because all these calculations depend on a choice of a given geometry. And I choose the geometry of a three sphere. So if you want the boundary of a four ball, which has it's only characterized by dimension, a size. So L is the radius, say, of this three sphere, and later on I will take L much bigger than the Planck length. I will be interested in the limit for large L. And okay, so now I have to interpret to connect the S spin network, which is a quantum geometry, to this geometry here. And so the way I want to do it, the standard way of doing it, is I choose a triangulation of the metric space. I choose a regular triangulation, and I interpret, I use quantum gravity, I use loop quantum gravity, which gives me exactly an interpretation for the spin network, right? The quantum gravity spin networks are interpreted as discretized geometry. So I take the geometry, I discretize, and I can identify it with the S. And I know from quantum gravity that the spins are the areas of the triangles, and allow me in this talk to just ignore the intertwiners altogether, because the calculation can be done ignoring it at this stage. Of course, then we'll have to take them into account to next order or to other components. So the spins, so let me just talk about the spins for concreteness. So there would be a spin network, which is sort of the best approximation to the geometry I have, in which the spin have a certain value, which I call J0, which depend on L, on the size of this thing here. And I want the state, remember that the state is just a function of the spin, this 10 spin, picked on this. So let me write very naively a Gaussian around it. And the Gaussian is determined by the width of the Gaussian, which I call alpha in this expression here. And this is my, for the moment, just the only free parameter I have, because J0 is determined by the background value on which I want this to be picked. But now, let me just tell you the story how we went through it. A Gaussian has a face. If I write a wave packet picked on some point, I still can add a phase, and of course the probability is still peaked on that point. So what is this phase? Well, the phase, we know from quantum mechanics, of a wave packet tells you how the wave packet is peaked on the conjugate variable. And here the variable is the geometry, is the metric of this sphere. The conjugate variable in generativity is extrinsic geometry. How is this folded? And in this discretized picture, the conjugate variable to the areas is the dihedral angles between tetrahedra. This, I mean, everybody who was familiar with regex calculus knows about that. In the next transparency, I have sort of a picture here of what is going on geometrically. Yes, please, next transparency. So this is transparency 13. So on the boundary, we have this S, right? S is this pentagon. So what is this pentagon? This is a spin network. So each one of its nodes is a tetrahedron. So it's a physical chunk of space, so to say. If you take a three sphere, you can just discretize it with five tetrahedra. That's like discretizing a two sphere with four triangles, one step up. And the links of the spin network have the spin J12, so these are dual to the triangles, and they represent the quantum numbers is the value of the angle of the area of these triangles. So the blue-green triangle there, which of course is attached to a similar triangle on the nearby tetrahedron. The area of this triangle is determined by the spin of the link of the J12. Now, to J12, there is a conjugate variable to it, it's conjugate momentum, so to say, which is the dihedral angle, big phi 12, which is the angle between the normals of the two tetrahedra. If you look at this in a regex calculus or in classical generativity, you have a four-dimensional space, so a tetrahedron is a three-dimensional object, it has a normal in four dimensions. And of course, in order to wrap around the sphere, two tetrahedra are bent at the surface where they meet. And there's an angle between the two, and this is phi. So if I want the state to be picked on a regular, on the three geometry of a three sphere, I know exactly, of a given size, I know exactly what is the value of the area of the triangles, but also what is the value of the phi. I can just compute it, and just a simple exercise in four-dimensional geometry, which it takes just a week to figure out, but everybody can do it with a little bit of exercise. So you can compute the background value of the phi that you want, and this fixes the state completely up to the single constant alpha. So I've just built the simplest minded Gaussian wave bucket on this background body. Can we go to the next? The last ingredient is the field operator. Now, what I am interested is something that I compare with the linearized theory, in which what I'm interested is the excitation generated by the fluctuations of the metric over a flat background. So I just, what I want, the operator I want is H, which is the metric minus delta. Here the metric, of course, is the E field, the Ashtaker electric field. I want the operator that corresponds to this E's, and I, of course, know how to write E operators on this Hilbert space, because that's exactly what we know how to do in quantum gravity. I know how to write operators which are sitting on a point in this network, but that's exactly what I want, because I want that to get to the question that Florian was asking. I want to have points X and Y, look at the figure, which are determined with respect to the geometry itself. So X and Y are, so to say, centers of two of these tetrahedra sitting on this spin network. So I define that. I have the three indices of the graviton propagator. Graviton propagator, of course, has four indices. I want to contract it with some geometrical quantities, which are natural here. The natural quantity is the normals to the triangles, which are dual to the two blue arrows there in the picture. There are some technicalities, so I can contract with these indices with these normals, and I get a quantity that depends also only on L, on the size of my three sphere. Okay, in parentheses, you can just take your undergraduate students and say, well, okay, this is a well-defined quantity, compute it in linearized the quantum generativity to zero order, to the linear theory, and there's a simple calculation, and that's the result is 1 over L squared times a constant there. So somehow, if things go correctly, we should get to this expression here. So let's go to the next transparency. I'm pretty close to the end. Well, this is just the showing what is M and N, transparency 15. So let's skip it and go to transparency 16, which is where the meat is. So here we are done. In a sense, we have defined all the quantities in the expression, and I just put them in the definition of my object, and now everything is perfectly well defined. And now it's just a matter of computing. There is nothing ill-defined for the moment. I have the expression for the field operators. I know how they act. I have an expression for the internal state and for the boundary state and for the amplitude. So the rest is calculations. But here is where the key technical thing happens, which is the following. In the first equation, the first long two-line equation, at the end, there is an exponential with a rapidly oscillating phase, which is given by the phase that I just told you is in the state. Okay, this is the phase that says that the boundary state is bent, so to say, in four-dimensional space-time. Now, just before this phase, there's a Gaussian thing, which picks the sum. The sum is over all the j, right? The sum of spinet was just to reduce the sum of the spins because the graph is big. So summing of the spins. Because of the Gaussian terms, the only spins that contribute are around JL. So there's a range of spins that contribute around this JL, but in this range, this phase factor oscillates rapidly and tends to kill the entire sum. And give zero, but it doesn't, because in the vertex there is exactly the same oscillating phase with an opposite sign. Why? Because remember that the vertex had this large spin expansion is exponential of the regiaction. Now the regiaction itself is the sum of the spins times the angle determined by those spins around a given force simplex. So if I expand the regiaction around the region where the sum is picked, so around JL, the first term is phi sum, and this is the last equation of this transparency, phi sum of the JM, where phi is what? Phi is the angle determined by the angle between the titillators determined by these spins in a flat space time. But that's exactly what I wanted to put in my state there. So the rapidly oscillating phase in the state cancels exactly with the rapidly oscillating phase generated from the regiaction. And that's not surprising, because that's what happens always, if you think about, when you do when you match semi-classical state at different times with a propagator in between. The semi-classical state, the reason the momentum is conserved is that the momentum in the initial wave packet and the momentum in the initial final wave packet are integrating with the propagator in between, and there is a similar cancellation which is between the phases such that the integrals survive only for the right momenta, so to say. So in other words, what is happening, it's technically complicated, but it's exactly the standard way in which function integrals know about the classical limit. Know how to match momentum in the classical limit. So the good part is that it only happens for one of the two terms in the Tenjé symbol in the vertex, and not for the D term. In other words, this is where, as I said at the beginning, this technical problem that we have one good term and two bad terms in the vertex get automatically solved, because one of them survives and the other disappears. Daniele Oriti and Etera had suggested some time ago that they represent sort of backward, the two exponentials represent sort of backward and forward propagation. And Colosi suggested some time ago that what should happen is that the state, the initial and final state, should know which component is the one that survives. It's a state that evolves ahead, a state that evolves backward. And all this is sort of happening in the complexity of the pool theory here. So this is sort of look reasonable. So thanks to that, a lot of these exponential cancel each other, and we go to the next transparency, which is 17. You can do the sum explicitly. This is you can approximate the sum with an integral, it's just a Gaussian integral, and what comes in, the result, is just the second terms in this function of the Regge action, that G. Here I'm slightly simplified the calculation. This is an early version of the calculation, which is a little bit simpler. If you look at the paper, it's slightly more complicated, but I just want to give you the main idea. So the result is that this W is the indeterminate constant alpha times this G. And G, what is this G? This is is what you get expanding the Regge action. And since the Regge action is the angle times J, this G is the derivative of the angle with respect to the spin. So in other words, you have a force simplex, you change the spin, and you see how the angle changes, and this is G. So in the next transparency, can you please put up the next transparency? There is now a series of transparencies, there's 18 and 19. This is a force simplex again, drawn a little bit different way. There's a green tetrahedron and a red tetrahedron. I've drawn them attached one to the other. And in blue, there is a triangle whose area this triangle that separates the two tetrahedra. The other side, there's another triangle. And if you change the area of that triangle, keeping all the other area fixed, the angle phi12 changes. If you switch between transparency 18 and 19, or if you put them on top of each other, whatever you want to do, this was done to do on a computer that just put on top of each other. And you see that by changing the area, upstairs, this gives the idea, the angle changes. So the first order variation of the angle as a change in the area is what is this G. And that turned out to be exactly the same result that some time ago, studying the three-dimensional theory with Daniele, Luisa, Florian, Leonardo, Karim, a lot of people, we got to the same geometry in studying the dynamics of 3D gravity just on a single tetrahedron. Transparency 20 and 21 show exactly the same gain, one dimension less. In that case, if you change the length of the green link, the angle between the two triangles change, becomes. This is much easier to visualize because this is the three-dimensional we're used to. So if you make this upstairs screen length shorter or longer, the angle changes. And the derivative of the angle with respect to the length is what determines the dynamics here and the coefficient of the propagator. So putting all that together, we get to transference 21. And that's the result. W of L, if you just do this calculation, is that quantity there, and we have to fix a numerical factor in the state that was free. So if this remember, is the width of the Gaussian, K is just a geometrical square root of 15 divided by something. If you fix K alpha property, you get the correct propagator. What is important, of course, is not the coefficient, which is chosen by choosing the width of the Gaussian property, but the 1 over L square, which in arbitrary coordinates with respect to the four-dimensional background metric, just x minus y square. So that's the calculation of the propagator. Of course, this is valid, a lot of approximation for large lengths, L square much bigger than h bar g. If we go in the small, this approximation breaks down, so we get corrections, and of course the interest is to look at this correction, and I've written this equivalent to the Newton law just to remind people that if you know the propagator, in principle you can from there get the Newton law to support. Let's go to next transparency. No, one is missing. There's one. There's the next. Sorry. 24. Okay. So transparency 23. So what has been done so far? What I've described is the general idea and the first order calculation in Lambda. Second order terms have been computed, not sure if all of them, and for the moment they do not seem to spoil the results. This is in the big paper I've indicated. Etera and Simone have a better definition of the boundary state. There is a detailed analysis in 3D dimension that was done by Devin Spital and Willis, and Dan Christensen has explored in detail all this numerically, trying to see whether these approximations are correct or not. There's a lot of approximations that have been taken. And I believe Simone next week will say much more about that, about the details of that. So transparency 24, what one has to do? Well, this is just the beginning, obviously. It's not an arrival point, it's a starting point. What I've is computed so far is just one piece of the propagator. There are other pieces for which one has to work with the full structure of the intertwiner and so on, and Emanuele Alesci is working on that. It's far from obvious that we have are at the end of what is the understanding the full role of the boundary state and what it has. There are other high-order terms in Lambda that here in Marseille, Davide Mamone is trying to compute. Of course, this is in one specific model, which was chosen just because it's the one that simplified the calculation. So there are other models, other versions of the theory in which similar calculation was done. And of course, what is interesting is not the two-point function, is the full endpoint functions where one starts to see the complexity of the theory. One has to do that with matter, and there's a lot to do about that. And then I just referred here to this idea that if this works, it would be great to arrive at sort of fixing this way the normalization constant of the perturbative theory. So the last transparency is 25. This is the conclusion. I just summarize everything that I've said. First of all, the graviton propagator so far appears to come out correct, first order in Lambda, in this sense. A sort of side bonus that one has obtained is some understanding of the fact that this apparent problem with the Bartkin vertex has gone away. And I insist once more that what I myself find interesting in this is not so much the specific of the calculation done so far or with this version of the theory, but rather a general way of computing endpoint functions, so to say, living not on a space but living on a quantum state. I think perhaps this general idea still needs to be adapted and cleaned up, but at least one sees how to get to compute low energy quantities starting fully from a background event formally. So I would stop here and take questions.
Thank you, Carlo.
Nice to be clouded by phone. It's a funny sensation.
Okay, Carlo, I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
Okay, so first is really I would like to Laurent's question. Can you hear me well?
We have a trouble to hear you.
There is a lot of echo.
Okay, maybe Carlo, you may want to switch off your microphone just for a second.
I'll come back when.
Okay, I think it's now better.
Yes.
Okay, so I think I have two questions. The first goes back to Laurent's question, and this is really about the choice of the state. And first, let me say what my answer would have been, and then I would like to express some confusion. My answer would be that, yes, the higher order corrections will depend on the choice of state. Then Laurent would come back and say, but when people then do scattering amplitudes, they get a precise answer, and we should give them a precise answer. So which state should we choose? And my answer would have been that we should choose a state which in appropriate sense is a ground state in the asymptotically flat context. In other words, the state should not be just put in by hand, but should be dynamically determined in the asymptotically flat context as being the ground state, and then there is a unique state, and then one would actually find, calculate in that unique state what the propagator is, including corrections of the type Planck length divided by the separation between the two points. However, so this looks all very nice, and at least, I mean, it's difficult, but it looks nice. However, I think when we look at the details of the calculation that Carlo just presented us, he had to adjust the width of the Gaussian, namely the parameter alpha, to a very precise value. Otherwise, one does not get the correct coefficient in front of the in front of the propagator or in front of the Newton's law. So this alpha was to be exactly equal to alpha squared was equal to 16 pi squared k squared, so to say. But now if I came along and I chose a slightly different semi-classical state with a slightly different value of alpha, it still is going to be a very, very good semi-classical state. It's just that the uncertainty is between the areas and angles is slightly different, differently distributed. But then for that state, I would not get the correct propagator. So there seems to be a problem even in the leading order term. And my questions are, do Carlo and Simone agree with this? And secondly, what is their viewpoint about how to, are they saying that in fact, therefore in this particular ansatz, alpha should have in fact a very specific value, and that is the only state that is allowed, or do they have something else to say?
Here I am. I have to replug the telephone to reappear, so it takes some time. Maybe Simone wants to answer, and we'll have an answer different than mine. The answer to this last question, specific question, is that I don't know. I don't have a specific point of view, and I don't have clear ideas about that.
The situation I agree. Can I add something, in fact?
Let me finish, Simone.
Sure.
The question becomes even a little bit more intricated as you go ahead, in the sense that we started with a very simple ansatz, which is a Gaussian sort of diagonal. There are the matrix of the covariance matrix is diagonal. So if you start from a non-diagonal covariance matrix, you already have already more constants there. Now, I have some ideas, but these ideas are confused and are evolving. And let me say this. This entire program started, in fact, as a attempt to determine dynamically the vacuum state. The idea, the old papers about that are formulated saying, can we just do the functional integral outside and take the surface to be sufficiently large and, in a sense, do the analog of what you do when you take the t equal infinity limit in the Euclidean propagation to define the vacuum, say, in harmonic oscillator. Can we do the same in this? Then the program sort of turned upside down and say, well, no, let's compute the endpoint functional state. In a sense, the reason you are beginning to ask these questions, which are I think are very appropriate, is before we could see how the state is connected to the endpoint function. So I think these are the right questions to ask. The only reason I hesitate in taking any position is that the data we have are sort of evolving rapidly as we learn more about that. So I would like to understand more how many free parameters are there, how much they are related to the how much they're fixed, how much they're I don't know how much constraint there is on this boundary state. So the answer is that my answer is that these are good questions, and I hope that this sort of calculation could help answering them. No more than that. Maybe Simone can say more.
I agree that that's a good question that is too early to answer, unfortunately. Just to give an idea, for instance, we know that higher orders in the lambda expansion of the group field theory will still contribute the leading order of the propagator. So we still give terms as 1 over L squared. So it is not clear how many terms in the expansion in lambda you should sum before making the real physical comparison with the ordinary low-energy propagator. So there's still work to do on this, I think.
Okay. One quick question to both of you. When you specify the state and calculate the area and so on, the Barbero emergency parameter never appeared. And that is presumably because in the Euclidean domain, you're using kind of self-dual, anti-self-dual representation, where effectively the parameter is equal to 1. Is this correct?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This is in the... Yes.
Yeah. I would have a comment and question. Can you hear me properly?
Yes, very well.
Okay, this is Florian.
Hi, Florian.
It's a comment about the group fields here, or rather about the perturbative expansions that are involved in this calculation. It seems to me that there are two perturbative expansions here that are conceptually very different. The one is the expansion of the group field theory that generates the spin foam sum, and the other is the expansion of the Reggie action that you do on page 16 on that transparency, where you introduce the delta J and expand the Reggie action around the background metric. And that expansion seems to me much similar like the expansions that are done in traditional perturbative quantum gravity where they use metrics. And that's my comment. And my question is the following. It's a question about the purpose of the first expansion, namely the expansion of the group field theory. What is really the purpose of this expansion in this scheme? You said initially that the motivation is to get triangulation dependent independence. The group field theory generates a sum over many triangulations, and therefore you hope that this will get rid of any dependence on the triangulation. Now, my problem with this is the following. Typically, perturbative expansions in quantum field theory are asymptotic. That means that for them to make sense, for them to be an approximation of the whole expression, you have to stop after a certain number of terms. Now, if that was true here, that suggests that you have to stop at a certain order in the expansion in lambda, depending on the size of lambda. So if we have only a sum over a finite number of triangulations anyway, that means what is then really the point of having this expansion if we are ending up with a finite number of lattices anyhow? Because you don't really have a sum over infinitely many triangulations. So my question is, ultimately, why don't we simply forget about the group field theory expansion and consider just a spin form sum on a fixed lattice that is very fine?
Yes. About the first question, you're right. The expansion of the Reggie action is not nothing to do in a sense with the expansion of lambda in the calculation. So you're right, there are two. The expansion of the action is ultimately an expansion in 1 over L, which is there in the calculation. So in the calculation, in fact, this is done in the L is the size of the surface, right? The distance between the points. So we are working in the large L limits, and we're computing first order term in lambda. The two things are separated, as you say correctly. When we expand the Reggie action is the L one, not the lambda one. And at the end of the day, what we want to understand is the relation between the two. So this the second order term will be crucial. I mean, we can speculate on what we expect this to happen. We've been doing that over and over and over for months here. But most of the speculations then are contradicted by experience. The good point is that we can compute and see if really. How things are. So I'm not daring telling you how I expect the 1RL expansion and the lambda expansion to be related. Now, on the other hand, about the other question, the second question, which is more structural, there I want to dare speculating because somehow it might give you some intuition that I have, I don't know if my collaborators have similar in doing this. Namely, the expansion in lambda is clearly an expansion in the number of it is an expansion in the number of vertices. So if you look at this in the dual, it's an expansion of the number of four simplices, right? So what is happening if I could compute all the terms in this expansion? Well, I expect that if the four simplices are too many, this is not going to contribute anymore in the following sense. What we're doing here is a standard sort of path integral, right? Now, we know that if we have in usual quantum mechanics, initial and finally boundary state, initial and finally state, then the path integral, say a particle in one point and a particle in another point, then the path integral is sort of dominated by the classical trajectory, and which means that you can approximate the path integral with paths that are sort of not too far from the trajectory if you do it in a discretized way. Now here, if you make a triangulation sufficiently extremely fine with many four simplices, and let me drop for the moment the case of simplices of zero volume because I'll come back to that in a moment. Then, if there are too many simplices and they have finite volume, this is going to have a lot of four-dimensional volume inside, and this will be farther and farther away from the classical geometry inside the sigma, which has a given volume, which is fixed, which is of the order of L to the fourth, right? And again, this is very rough, so I'm not considering the possibility that the volume of the individual simplices can be arbitrary small, things like that. So what I expect is that the contribution of this integral goes down when the number of simplices are too small. Of course, if the number of simplices is too large. The number of simplices is small, you can still have contribution by simply making the simplices large, so there's no problem from that side. Now, of course, one could work, let me come now to the apparently technical point of simplices over zero volume. This is more something we have discussed in the past. If you work with a very fine triangulation, and you include in the sum the spins of value zero, then there is the point that you can. This is like having Feynman diagrams in which you have zero momentum. It's like taking away this line here. So you can express terms of lower order, effectively lower order in lambda, inside terms of higher order in lambda. This is so I don't think that your suggestion it's wrong. Your suggestion, I think it's I wouldn't think the wrong direction to go conceptually, not at all. If you take a sufficiently fine triangulation, what you lose is irrelevant because these are the what what you lose is geometries which are too big for volume. And inside there are hidden also the terms that contribute, provided that you take the zero spin into account as well. Now, concretely, why don't we do that? Well, because that's what we are able to do. It's much easier to start from the terms that it's much easier to have a perturbative parameter and expand into that. If you have a way to compute on a fixed larger triangulation and then somehow show that it's sufficiently fine to capture everything, but if you have a way to compute in that way, we'll be happy to know. So, in other words, from the technical point of view, the fact of having a parameter in which you expand is exactly what allows us to do this calculation.
Okay, thank you. I see your point.
Can I add something? This is Laurent.
Hi, sure, Laurent.
Concerning this expansion in lambda, it seems to me there is a proposal in the literature which allows a much shorter answer. So essentially, what you can do is you can look at what's the physical meaning of this lambda and in group V theory, and you realize that lambda is an amplitude for a change of topology of quantum gravity amplitude. So a natural, and then there's a long series of arguments also that argue that GFT is a third quantization of gravity. So a natural proposal for the scalar product in group V theory is to restrict to the classical sector of group V theory, that is summing only over a three-level diagram. In that case, lambda is just like a loop parameter, counting the number of loops in your expansion, and you should just take the terms which are of lambda equal to zero. And in some sense, you know, we show that it satisfies, in some sense it's consistent in the sense that the Schwinger-Dyson equation for this truncation gives the kernel to the physical scalar product. This is what you expect, whereas the full one doesn't have, et cetera, et cetera. And the only trick is to take lambda, and you can think of lambda as a coupling, a constant parameter, but by rescaling the field, you can just think of it as being in front of the action, like a H-bar parameter. And if you take the second point of view, then there is a physical meaning, and there is a prescription. And the prescription is just that, given two spin networks, you just sum over the number of three-level triangulation, which is a finite sum, and everything is fine. And in some sense, the computations they are doing, because the spin network is very simple, just agrees with this computation. They don't take into account loop diagram. Well, that was my remark.
I just want to comment on this remark. I agree. You perhaps shouldn't call it expansion in lambda because you should find a different name, because otherwise everybody's getting confused. I mean, if you're scaling the field, so the same terms have a different order in the expansion lambda I'm writing and the expansion lambda you're writing. So in other words, what has been computed so far is first order terms and second order terms in lambda according to this terminology, what we mean by expansion in lambda, but you would call these zero order terms in lambda. These are all terms with zero bubbles, so to say, with zero loops. So I'm happy with the same calculations done in this, the way you want to define the theory in this way. I'm very happy. In fact, I'm not saying that the definition of the theory we're taking, I'm not defending the definition of the theory we're taking. I'm just proposing this same calculation to be done with different definitions, including the one in which you're talking about, in which you only look for terms without loops, without bubbles, so to say.
Okay, just
so,
a second.
So I'm very happy.
So if you call Laurent's lambda L for, okay, and your lambda Carlo.
Yes, yes.
Then Laurent is saying that just look at L is equal to zero.
Yes.
The spin forms. But does that involve your summing all kinds of lambda terms in your calculation?
Yes, yes.
Only a finite number of them. Only a finite number of terms.
Okay, but still it's a finite number of them, and therefore we still have to worry about this higher order corrections. Are they you know, are they good or are they not, etc. Right?
Does
the result continue until this finite order term?
Yeah, we still have to worry about the corrections. Why do you say they're a finite number, Laurent?
Oh, because at tree level, if you fix the boundaries in networks, they're just a finite number of trees that interpolate. And the change from L to lambda is just a rescaling. So you can always take it out of the or in front by rescaling. By rescaling the field, you can always take it out of the expectation value. And the nice thing is that you can give a physical meaning to it, really. So that's the key difference. The L has really this physical meaning. But it is only a finite number of terms.
And how do you fix the boundary of the network?
Right, but that's what you do, right?
No.
Once you fix the state, your coherent state is defined on one spin network.
No, right. First order in lambda. Not to high order.
So what I'm saying is that for a fixed boundary state.
Yeah, sure. Then fine.
Then
yes.
There is only
then
a finite
sure.
So each time the computation is that given a graph and a coherent state on that, then there is only and it's triangulation independent. There is a result which is triangulation dependent, which involves only finite number of terms.
Yeah.
And then if you change, of course, I mean. Somehow the graph you put is part of the data of the boundary state. So when you change the boundary...
In the way you want to do it, yes. Not in the way it's done so far.
Well, in the way you do, you also fix some boundary graph.
No. This is only because there's an expansion parameter, and to this order, this is the only part that contributes.
Well,
there's nothing fixed. The data here are Q and two positions.
No,
two
but
points
the data is this choice of the data is this choice of boundary states you're coherent states you're taking. So either you decide this coherent state is supported on many graphs or is supported on one graph. So depending on your choice of coherent states, then you have different but you have a sum or not. But the sum comes.
Okay, I think they're trying to ask us to get off the phone because our reserve time is off.
Oh, okay.
So I think this is a very, very interesting thing, but maybe we should continue next time.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Carlo.
Bye.
Bye.